ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Apple is in trouble. And this time, it's with the United States government. Yes, this week on Download This Show, in a landmark lawsuit, the US government are accusing the world's most valuable technology company of behaving like a monopoly, particularly in relation to how it treats its iPhone customers. But exactly what is on the line? Also on the show this week, we are talking about former US President Donald Trump. He has a social media company called Truth Social. It's about to go public, but why? And why now? And what are the stalwarts of internet culture? Reddit, the forums beloved by generations of internet users, is about to undergo a massive change. And what exactly happens when you put a computer chip in a person's brain? You're about to find out. This is your guide to the week in media, technology, and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to a brand new episode of Download This Show. Yes, indeed, it is a brand new week of Download This Show. And a very big welcome to our panellists this week. Our co-founder of Patient Note, Sarah Moran, missed you.
Ah, lovely to be back. Missed you too.
And reporter extraordinaire with The Guardian, Josh Taylor, welcome back.
Great to be back again.
That's right. You can all be extraordinaries, by the way. Sarah is also extraordinaire. And you as a listener, also extraordinaire. So let's talk about the most valuable technology company in the world, apparently going to court in the US. Sarah, what's happening with Apple?
Oh my goodness. I love this. I love drama. I'm glad we're leading with this one. So, look, it's not just the biggest tech company in the world. Apple has gone to court with Epic, who is one of the leaders in the games world. And so this is like games versus mobile phone technology, if you like, essentially around how we pay for games and subscriptions. And as most of us know by now, Apple likes to take their cut, their clip of the ticket. And some people are finding that quite cost prohibitive. One of those people is Tim from Epic, and he has taken on this battle. And as I said, get your popcorn out because this one's quite a bit of drama. And I'm going to hand over to Josh because he is well across the depth of it.
So there's Apple and Epic, but then also there's the US government and Apple, Josh.
Yeah. So the Department of Justice in the US on late last week launched this case against Apple, alleging basically six aspects where they think that Apple is stifling competition. And it's kind of the things that we're hitting on in the Epic game case in Australia and sort of more generally. It's basically the restrictions in the App Store, only being able to download apps through the App Store, the suppression of what they call so-called super apps, which is basically like how WeChat operates in China, where you basically go just to that app for everything that you want. Cloud streaming apps, so basically the ability to play multiple different games within the one app. Restrictions on how non-Apple smartwatches interact with the iPhone. So basically, you know, no third-party watch is going to be as good as the Apple Watch. And they basically saying this is because it's the competition's being stifled. Restrictions on the digital wallet. So basically, you know, who can access it, how the payments are made and things like that. And then the thing that is a cause of consternation for a lot of people, the green bubble versus the blue bubble. So being able to use iMessage on platforms that aren't Apple's own.
Okay, so obviously we've got this sort of cluster of legal activity, but let's just focus on the one with the US government and Apple for a second here. Sarah, when you look at this case, what do you think is actually at stake here? Because it seems like there's a sort of a plethora of issues that are sort of under the microscope at the moment.
Yeah, and it's even more broadly than what's been taken to court. We've known for a while that Apple is a closed ecosystem and they like it that way. What we experience as consumers is a limitation on what we can access, but also as creators. So I happen to live with an iPhone developer, and it is a constant talking point in our household about how hard it is to be able to create stuff on the App Store and charge for it. And I think that's one of the broader issues that's worth exploring, is what it means for us for consumers. It's not just a big legal case. It's something that will affect us and how we can use these things going forward.
What about for Apple itself, Josh? What's at stake here for them?
Well, I mean, this is their castle. They've built their entire fortune. Well, not in their entire fortune, but increasingly, all of their money is being made through, you know, services that they provide through their devices. And opening it up would open up a whole world of things. I thought it was interesting in the opening sort of what they call the anecdotal lead of the lawsuit. They bring up an email where some Apple exec points to a Kindle ad where at the time it was showing someone being able to sort of pick up their Android device to start reading and then move over to an iPhone and start picking up and reading where they left off on the other device. And Apple thought this was horrible. They don't want people being able to get outside the ecosystem. Once you're in the Apple ecosystem, you're trapped. And you know so many people who are there, they're either in the Apple ecosystem or they're with Google, and that's basically the limitations of it. They're worried about people getting outside of that. And I think that at stake here is not only just being, you know, trapped within their ecosystem, but also the money that Apple's making from all the services that it provides through this.
Out of curiosity, Josh, how different is the setup on Apple to, say, Android, right? Are there similar issues that are replicated in other mobile phone operating system providers?
So they're similar but different. Google has constantly prided itself on being much more open a platform. So if you want on an Android device, you have the ability to download an app directly onto phone without having to go through the Google Play Store. There are alternative app markets in place. They operate differently with the wallet in terms of opening it up to other things, which is why, for example, in Victoria, you can use Mikey on your Android, whereas we don't have that on iOS at the moment. It was interesting. So when this antitrust suit with Epic went through in the US, the judges actually sided with Apple, but Google actually lost its case on the grounds that although it was open, it was been seen to be making deals to encourage people to stay within the Google Play environment, and that was counter to sort of competition in the market. So there are a lot of similar issues, but there are differences that in the way that they're being argued both here and in the US.
It's early days, but Sarah, how do you imagine, play me through the different outcomes here.
Yeah, look, well, I mean, this will set a legal precedent. So whatever falls out of the back of this is going to influence how we make things moving forward. There could be some settlements. So some cash could definitely be on the table for different people and, you know, possibly future lawsuits. But the way that we think about how the industry is going to be shaped really does hinge on what these decisions are. Obviously, this will impact us in Australia because this, you know, the companies are based out of America, and that really will shape, you know, how are we going to approach these business practices? And we cop that globally, regardless of the outcome of this decision, which I think is quite interesting.
It's worth pointing out, Josh, that I think this move to sort of walled gardens where you can, you know, increasingly your entire world exists within a Google world or an Apple world, it's been a sort of a slow creep, right? If you think about the early days of the internet and the early days of technology, you know, with the inflection point of, I guess, really the iPhone sudden and the App Store and all the things kind of flow from that, this idea that you were locked into a particular universe has sort of kind of crept up on us. So is this going to be the inflection point where that all changes, Josh?
I feel like it is. It's reminding me a bit of, you remember the bad old days when Microsoft was the big company and you know, Bill Gates was being represented as Darth Vader and everyone was saying that he was the big, you know, assimilating all the competition and killing off everything else. And then there were cases that sort of sought to break up what Microsoft was doing. I feel like we're at that inflection point at the moment as well. It's not just the US cases and obviously what Epic's doing here, but we've got regulators in Australia looking at how to make this a bit more of a fair system and open up for consumers. Europe's obviously just passed the Digital Markets Act, which has forced Apple to make a lot of the changes that are being sought both in the US and in Australia happen over there, albeit the way Apple has interpreted the legislation is not great. But it does feel like we're at that point where everyone's realized Apple is far too big, far too powerful, and it is actually making the phone experience for customers a lot worse because they're not getting all those options that they otherwise would if there was more competition in the market.
Download the Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. Our guest this week, Josh Taylor, reporter with The Guardian and co-founder of Patient Notes, Sarah Moran. Mark Fennell is my name. And Donald Trump is looking like he's going to have a big 2024. No, I'm not talking about the election. I'm talking about his social media service. Sarah, Truth Social, for people that haven't heard of it before, what exactly is it?
So it's a social media platform, and it's owned by Donald Trump's media company, Trump Media and Technology Group, and it's ready to go public. It's going to go through a merger with Digital World Acquisition Corp, a special purpose acquisition company, SPAC, and he's expected to own at least a 58% stake in that merged entity. So, like, that's megabucks. We're talking nearly $3 billion based on the current share prices. And yes, it's that is a lot of money for any tech company.
So this is a social media service that sort of caught people's attention, particularly when Trump was booted off Twitter, Josh. I'm going to go ahead and assume most of us haven't necessarily used it. Is there anything that makes it distinctive than, say, your Twitters and Facebooks in terms of how people actually use it?
I mean, it pretty much looks like Twitter and Facebook. The difference is, last time I checked, it was a fairly closed network. So Donald Trump is a little bit shouting into the void all the time. I've noticed that there's actually sort of Twitter accounts that repost what he posts on Trump social, so you can get a sense of what he's been posting on that website. And it's, you know, not great, but It is interesting that this is sort of catching on now. They've been trying to list for a few years, but it's one of those things. It's a weird stock market system. We have a similar thing in Australia where if you want to list, you have to buy a company that will let you list and go through that whole process. And now they've finally been able to do it. So the timing is sort of working out for Trump to potentially profit. He can't sell his stake in it immediately. I think he has to wait about 6 months before he can sell it. So it'll be closer to, I guess, the election when that can all happen, but it does stand to be a lot of money for him.
Out of curiosity, why now? Sarah, I mean, you know, we're staring down the barrel of a presidential election in the US. Why is he making this move now?
Look, I mean, I'm never going to try to pretend to be a Trump mind reader, but if it were me, I think about what it means for engagement and another media narrative. If you think about the way that a lot of people organise in the US, there is technology that's backing that. But this is just my interpretation of if I was Trump, and I am not. You know, he doesn't have Twitter, but he has created his own platform. And to be able to raise attention around that platform at a time where he's going to be needing votes, needing people showing up, this is an accessible way for people to participate in community organising. So Twitter was the place where that happened. He now has his own version of that. And, you know, even if this doesn't come off, he's got a big run up to market to say, here's where your people are. Come and hang out with me. You know, this is where you get my direct voice, which could happen on the platform anyway. But as we know, the attention around the platform has died off. So my guess, this very big guess, is to say that, yes, it's about the money, and that will be very helpful to his campaign, but also the community organizing and the ability to engage stakeholders on the ground in a way that they feel like they're part of a club. It all sort of rolls together as to part of that bigger strategy.
Your thoughts, Josh, on the timing?
Well, I think it's basically, you know, now's the time to do it because it's what they call a meme stock. So if you remember the GameStop thing a few years ago where everyone was sort of investing in it, it wasn't based on any actual what they think the company is worth, whether it's going to be profitable, because apparently it's not really that good at making money. I think it had something like $5 million in ad sales or something like that. But people wanting to be associated with the Trump brand and being seen to be investing in that is why they think it's probably a good time to hit, you know, sale on it. And obviously after the election, regardless of the outcome, that will probably be much lower. So I can understand why they're trying to do it now.
We're at an interesting turning point in the life of Twitter, which I am just going to keep calling Twitter because X, the name it was given, is just nonsense. Obviously, it's come under the control of Elon Musk, and there's been an exodus of a lot of users, and it went through a period of sort of being mired in scandal after scandal after scandal. And at the same time, there was a whole host of copycats, because I think everybody recognizes that there is a space for a service like that. It is a huge way of finding out information in real time. Therefore, we get things like Blue Sky Social, Threads from Meta, the company behind Facebook and Instagram. And then there's sort of Truth Social in the mix there. So what we have is a glut of competitors, right? Does Truth Social have anything to... And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of people that still remain on Twitter because, you know, they've built up followings and they're stuck there. Not speaking for anyone in particular here. So when it comes to the competitors, Sarah, does Truth Social have anything that makes it better? Like, just functionally?
It depends for who. Like, the simplistic nature of it makes it available to, you know, like, this is targeting Trump's user base. And so the usability is appealing to them. It is definitely not appealing to me. And I have felt the absolute destruction of community organizing of communities that I'm involved with when Twitter was obliterated. I don't have an equivalent of Truth Social that has sprung up and been funded to meet with my communities. Instead, I've got those generic, as you mentioned, Blue Sky Social, Threads, and Mastodon. But this is a dedicated community, you know, like, and it's bankrolled. And I see that value. I would suggest it's not worth $3 billion. But for those who have created it, like, it isn't just a tech play, and it's not just a usability play. It is definitely a, you know, it's a community organizing campaign, possibly propaganda, like, app.
For you, Josh, is there anything that separates it?
Well, I think it's all about Trump, really. So Elon Musk did actually restore Trump's Twitter account recently, and he hasn't posted. It was probably about a year ago he actually restored it now, but the only time he has posted was to post a photo of his mugshot when he was taken in for processing. And I think that the reason why, you know, as much as he probably really wants to tweet at the moment, is because that this is valuable to him. He is the commodity for this, so they're trying to keep him on there as long as possible to make the money for people who are wanting to be a part of Trump's social network. And essentially, I think he's just the key seller for them.
Looking more broadly, I mean, just putting Truth Social to one side, right? That glut of alternatives that I mentioned, it doesn't really strike me that even with the might of Meta, the company behind Facebook and Instagram behind it, Threads has an active user base. It doesn't seem to have attained the sort of level of sort of cultural impact that Twitter had. Is that a thing that's just going to take time, or is it just never going to be repeated again?
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
I would say it's also happened at the time with the rise of TikTok. So if you think generationally, like I joined Twitter in 2007 and, you know, I'm old now, but the next generation of people coming through who are enthusiastic and have more, have time to be online and sharing stuff, TikTok has risen in the time that Twitter has declined. And I think that communities moving in different spaces and having different tech expectations is definitely a part of that mix.
Yeah, I think TikTok to a degree has done that, but I think that also we are seeing a great shift in what the internet is actually for. I think we're seeing a shift away from this sort of social human aspect of it. And now that the advent of AI being available everywhere and everywhere, there's sort of that dying of that human connection that we're seeing online. And I think that is seen nowhere more than Twitter. And the fact that no real replacement has built up that community to the same degree is quite telling. I think it's interesting from the TikTok perspective that we're looking at the same time as the US potentially banning it. Meta's version of it called Reels is actually taking off. That we're a little bit like the Apple discussion. We're going back into this space where a lot of the places where people communicate is being siloed within a few different corporations, and we basically are all at the whims of whoever owns that product.
You are listening to Download This Show. It is your guide to the week in media, technology, and culture. And over in the US, there is a man with a chip in his brain. It's called Neuralink, and it's one of a suite of different technology companies that are experimenting with new ways in which technology can interface directly with the human brain. For people that haven't heard of Neuralink before, Josh, kind of walk me through it.
So it seems like Neuralink, we're basically relying on what Elon Musk is telling us about how it's going. So take that with a grain of salt, obviously. But it seems at the moment that the way the technology works, you can basically move things on a computer. You can have some basic controls over things that you otherwise wouldn't have access to. And they sort of showed demos of I think he was playing Civilization on a computer. And this is obviously giving people a lot of space to, if they need to use their hands for other things or are incapable of using their hands to undertake the normal tasks you would undertake, this is where they see the value for this technology so far.
And there is an enormous potential here, isn't there, Sarah?
So much potential and so much scary stuff that can happen off the back of that. And we're just, you know, particularly with the increase of everything AI at the moment, learning what that potential looks like is, you know, a bit throw it out there and see what comes back. So there's concerns a lot at the moment. I mean, I have concerns around brain privacy and the risk of hacking and all of the ethical implications that come off the back. But that opportunity that's sitting there is pretty darn important.
So Neuralink is one of the technology companies, one of many that Elon Musk is involved with. Has he spoken much about it, Josh?
He's spoken in bits and pieces about it. He kind of thinks that this is the next level of the game, incorporating obviously is the advancement of AI. I think that it's been interesting to watch. There were a lot of stories around when he first started doing about like potential harm that were done to monkeys in the process of developing this technology. So I'm a little bit wary about when he's sort of doing the advancing here about how much it's going, because he does have a mixed record in terms of his advancements. Obviously, Tesla and SpaceX are doing great, but it's sort of we tend to discuss quite a bit. He's pushes into other areas such as AI and Twitter are not so great.
Yes, it is an intriguing space, right, where technology can interface directly with the human brain. What's the regulatory environment around that? Like, there's any surgery comes with dangers, right? When something like this happens, no doubt there's enormous potential here, but what are the sort of regulations around that exist in different parts of the world? Does anyone know?
I think it's the sort of the usual regulatory approvals in terms of getting medical approval and things like that. That's the thing that often with technology, it comes in and you kind of look at how existing regulations might fit into it. And we're doing that with AI at the moment a fair bit. And I think a lot of the issues that are raised with the implantation of medical devices into people's brains will be stuff that we already do regulate in terms of medical side of things, but there will be unforeseen things in terms of, as Sarah mentioned, the privacy protection and of people's brain data and things like that. And I guess things like who has access to this technology, what are the approvals for? Because we don't want sort of, I guess, dodgy brain chip operators out there offering bargain basement chips that causing fatalities and things like that. Things like that that we'll have to think about as this technology advances.
Is there a sense, Sarah, of how much, I mean, this is very, very early days for this technology, but is there a sense of how soon it might become a more prominent part of the way we interact with technology?
I mean, we've been talking about Neuralink for quite a while, but, you know, I think what will probably happen is that it'll be something really simple that hits the market first, right? Like, there's so much potential for therapeutic purposes and, you know, the basics. Like, I'm surprised, you know, when AI hit the market, the basic thing we did was, can you just read this spreadsheet a bit better, right? Like, and I think that's my anticipation is that that's what will hit the market first, is something really simple as opposed to big scary brain stuff. It's the little, you know, the little increments that will come to market first. And so, I don't know. I'm excited to see if that happens, but also we'll be talking about Neuralink still in 10 years and its potential. I'm not sure.
What do you think, Josh?
Well, I think it has the potential to offer a lot of improvements for people who have accessibility issues and people who might have less ability than others in terms of just improving the quality of life if it is provided to them on an equitable basis. Done incorrectly, I don't know if anyone's played Cyberpunk 2077, which is basically a lot of people having chips installed in their bodies and their brains and stuff like that. But basically, you know, if you have a corporation that is in control of the hardware that you have installed on your body, you know, what happens when their license runs out or they don't like supporting what you're doing? Are they going to shut down your body? Things like that. There's a lot of questions that are still to be answered, I think.
Download This Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. And once upon a time, there was a saying, possibly apocryphal saying, that if you saw a good internet meme or a good bit of internet content, it probably started its life on the forums of Reddit. Reddit is sort of one of the stalwarts of internet culture. It's been around a long time, but does it have a future? Now, let's just start with what it is. Sarah, for people that have never used Reddit before, how would you go about describing it?
Well, Reddit, it feels like a forum. It is where people can ask questions. There's a lot of functionality where, you know, that so you can upvote things. So things, the good stuff floats to the surface. So when you log in, it feels like a news page. And that news could be based on interests that you have or groups that you've joined, or just, you know, here's the top stuff of the internet. I'm actually a new user to Reddit. So when it comes to growth of this platform, I downloaded the app this year and fired it up, doing more than just your casual browsing. So I'm really excited to see a renewed interest in Reddit and what it has moving forward.
So the way I see Reddit is, it's where people go to find answers on the internet. And it's built this lots of communities of like-minded people, because basically you can set up your own subreddit on what you are interested in, or you can find subreddits on topics that you're interested in, and you're finding like-minded people who share similar interests to you. And I think that this is one of the things that we've kind of lost with the talk about Twitter and a lot of the other social networks, where everyone is just angry and yelling at each other all the time because they just disagree violently on everything else. And you've got a very passionate community. Often the people who run the subreddits are volunteers and they're doing it for free and things like that. And they are all working together for what they see as a greater good. And they're, you know, Reddit has had its flaws over the years. There have been issues. The moderators did hold a protest last year over changes to the platform and things like that. But I think that if we're looking at what is one of the good things about the internet, I think Reddit is one of those things still.
And so after all these years of being around and supplying us with internet culture, it's launched on the US Stock Exchange. Why did they suddenly feel the need to kind of go on the stock exchange, Josh, do you think?
I don't actually know the reason why they wanted to, but it seems like they've constantly been battling trying to become profitable, essentially. And one of the things that is appealing to advertisers for their platform is that you do have those subreddits where the content within those subreddits are things that people can lay ads against without actually knowing a huge amount about the people they're advertising with, apart from they're interested in that particular topic. It'll be interesting to see how it goes. It comes that they're also making deals with AI companies to use Reddit information to train data, and that's obviously had a mixed response from the people who are otherwise supplying that free information to Reddit as well through their posts and things like that. But it seems like that it's similar to, you know, I guess the VC era of the internet is somewhat dying a little bit, whereas all the money is sort of going to AI companies and things like that now, and there's not so much money for social web, so they've got to try and figure out how to get money other ways.
What do you see as the future of Reddit, Sarah? Like, given something's been around for so long, what are the opportunities? What are the opportunities for a service like that?
Well, I think that's the point. So being around so long, there's... I mentioned that I joined this year, but what I mean is, like, I have used Reddit over the years when I have a question. When I search for something, a Reddit response or a Reddit thread often comes up, but I've not engaged in that community side of things. And so the reason I joined was because I had questions about IVF, and to access adult content, which IVF fell into the category of, you need to download the app and sign up and actually say, yes, I am an 18-year-old, please give me access. And so... there's the potential, you know, apart from the fact that there is the monetization potential for Reddit is really exciting, because Reddit needs to be sustainable as it supports so many different communities of information and niche communities. And it's one of the few places left that does that. But I think there's also an opportunity to look at what that engagement looks like in terms of ways to engage people like myself. You know, I am now seeing ads that I didn't, you know, before, so that will help with their revenue on that side. But I think that when something's been around for so long, you can reintroduce it, right? Like you can relaunch it to a new community, whether that be young people or, you know, people who have different needs at different times. And I think once they have the revenue to be able to market themselves, other than just by word of mouth, I think that's going to be really exciting.
I think the other thing to mention is that we're seeing a lot of, you know, in search results and things like that, answers to questions are now being filled by machines like AI. You're getting AI responses, AI produced articles and things like that. Reddit seems to be the one place where you can still go where, through the upvoting system and everything like that, you're more likely to see content that answers your question from a human, essentially.
I'd also just add there's like a lot of localness to it. So, you know, if you think about the fact that local newspapers have dropped off, you may have your community groups on Facebook. So if you're in your local neighborhood Facebook group, you might find out some information. But I really like that there are subreddits. You know, there's a subreddit Australia, there's a subreddit of Brisbane, there's subreddits of cities. And so, you know, you do find out stuff that's relevant to you in a timely fashion that, you know, unfortunately, doesn't get reported anywhere else anymore. And I think there is never not going to be a place where that is valuable to the people using it.
And with that, we are out of time. Huge thank you to our guests this week. Sarah Moran, co-founder of Patient Notes. Always a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And Josh Taylor, reporter with The Guardian. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed the show or found something useful in it, make sure you head along to whichever podcasting app you happen to prefer and leave a review. And, of course, don't forget this show, download this show, and all other great ABC shows are available anytime you want on ABC Listen. I'm Mark Fennell, and I'll catch you next week. Until then, have a great week. Goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.